Welcome to the America's Workforce Radio Podcast, the flagship production of the American Workers Radio and Podcast Network, where organized labor and its never-ending fight to protect the rights of the American worker come first. Now, presented by LIUNA, Laborers International Union of North America, here's your host, Ed Flash Ferentz.
U.S. Supreme Court ruling, Biden's vaccine mandate, one win, one loss. Thousands of grocery workers go on strike in Colorado. Operating engineers avert a strike in Minnesota. And today on the show, the Parkersburg, West Virginia, and Marietta, Ohio building trades. And our labor lawyer, Joyce Goldstein, on the NLRB and what has changed at that agency. Welcome to the Friday, January 14th edition of America's Workforce, where we are available on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, iHeartRadio, Spotify, Pandora, and Stitcher. Buddy Malone is going to be our first guest on the show today. He's been on one time, maybe two times, about 4 to 6 months ago, and he comes to us from the Parkersburg, West Virginia, Marietta, Ohio Building and Construction Trades Council. Website is pmbtc.org. Buddy's been in the trades for 27 years, went through two apprenticeships, iron workers and the millwrights. He was a business agent for the millwrights for 9 years. Now, he is the business manager and financial secretary treasurer of the Parkersburg Marietta Building and Construction Trades Council, an organization comprised of local construction unions and their members who work in West Virginia and Ohio. Now, West Virginia, as you know, is a right-to-work state. We'll talk about how that has affected workers there. Prevailing wage, we'll get into that. We'll also talk about working with schools to show the value of the building trades. And hopefully, they're reaching out to as many as they can in the schools of West Virginia. I mean, talk about a poverty-stricken state. No better way. How many times you've heard me say, pathway to the middle class, pathway to the middle class. Well, that's the way to do it, especially if you live in a state like West Virginia. And I'm sure we'll get into that and more. Buddy Malone, our first guest on the show. Joyce Goldstein will be joining us later, and she's going to dissect what's been going on at the National Labor Relations Board. Number one, we're seeing a lot of organizing at Starbucks. How did that happen? What did they do to allow, I think it's like 10, maybe 11 stores across the nation, the big one, Buffalo, New York. And the last time we had Joyce on the show, that decision came down. So what did they specifically say that paved the way for that? There's also a report that the NLRB will delve into what an independent contractor is. This is huge, especially in the trades. And the Teamsters are dealing with this, too. Misclassification. I often say on the show, many employers today don't want employees. Why? They don't want the responsibility. They don't want to pay the taxes, Social Security, the benefits. They'd rather do, well, part-time. They'd rather go part-time, or they just contract you out. And then you have to do all the taxes. Get your own health care. Another issue is what happened during the Trump administrations. One of the board members, William Emanuel, who was pretty much a union buster, he owned stock in several companies that he was voting on. Now, don't you think he should have recused himself? Question is, when does someone recuse him or herself in certain cases? What are the ethics? What does the NLRB say about that? It is now reported, because of those rulings, they're going to redo them. So all the time and money that they spent is a waste. It's pretty significant that we talk about this now because, as you know, there's a record amount of workers quitting their jobs, and that's causing companies a whole lot of grief. And I'm willing to bet that a lot of those workers are not in unions. And if they are not in a union, they're organizing. That's what's going on. We're seeing pockets of organizing all around the country, and we're seeing workers go on strike because they're not getting what they want. And I have a couple of stories I'll get into shortly. So Joyce Goldstein will be wrapping that up as our second guest on the show today. Well, the U.S. Supreme Court, no surprise here, I guess, they issued two highly anticipated rulings yesterday, temporarily blocking a Biden administration COVID-19 vaccine mandate for large employers. We're talking 100 or more. However, they allowed a separate rule applying only to healthcare workers at facilities receiving federal fundings. Now, when the government is paying the bill, the government can call the shots, and that's exactly how they ruled yesterday. The high court settled the matter concerning large employers in a 6-3 decision to block the rule that would have been issued by OSHA, the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, with three liberal justices dissenting. And here's what the opinion stated. OSHA has never before imposed such a mandate, nor has Congress. Indeed, although Congress has enacted significant legislation addressing the COVID-19 pandemic, it has declined to enact any measure similar to what OSHA has promulgated here. As for healthcare facilities, the court ruled 5-4 to uphold, for now, the rule administered by the Department of Health and Human Services. Both Medicare, and this is a quote, both Medicare and Medicaid are administered by the Secretary of Health and Human Services, who has general statutory authority to promulgate regulations as may be necessary to the efficient administration of the functions of which he or she is charged. One such function, perhaps the most basic, given the department's core mission, is to ensure that the healthcare providers who care for Medicare and Medicaid patients protect their patients' health and safety. That's what the majority stated. Barely, it was 5-4 in that decision. Now, these rulings will take effect immediately and will remain in place until legal challenges over their constitutionality are resolved through the justice system. So we'll see what happens here. Now, as far as the employer mandate, that was announced, you may recall, in early November. The original effective date was January 4th, targeting about 84 million U.S. workers, or about half the workforce. Its deadline for employers to require masking was extended to January 10th. Full compliance, which the court's decision now renders unenforceable, had been extended to February 9th. So, bottom line, one win, one loss. But a lot of companies are saying, okay, you got to get the vaccine or at least show a negative test and wear a mask at work. So that's how it's going to be for the time being. United Food and Commercial Workers Local 7, which represents nearly 25,000 workers in Colorado and Wyoming, rejected what was termed the last, best, and final offer proposed by King Soopers, which is the largest grocery store chain in Colorado, and they are a subsidiary of the Kroger Company. As a result, they are on strike, involving nearly 10,000 workers at 78 locations across those two states. It began yesterday morning. The two sides have been negotiating a new contract for months, and the most recent collective bargaining agreement between them expired on the 8th of this month, January 8th. The union, which had already rejected several previous offers, deemed this last, best, and final offer, which proposed to increase wages by up to $4.50 an hour. Workers said no. By the way, it's reported the tensions in this dispute are pretty high. Local 7 of the food and commercial workers filed a lawsuit against King Soopers. This was late last month in federal court, claiming that the company had breached the then-current collective bargaining agreement by subcontracting bargaining unit work to third-party staffing services. On Monday, the company responded by filing an unfair labor practice charge with the National Labor Relations Board, accusing the union of refusing to bargain in good faith. Comment here from the president of that local, Kim Cordova. Kim said, our plea remains the same. Stop these unfair labor practices and respect us, protect us, and pay us what we deserve. Local 7 members will remain on strike until the company agrees to cease its unfair labor practices and comes to the bargaining table in good faith. This will be one to watch because you know a lot of frontline grocery workers have quit their jobs in the pandemic. They're not going to find anybody to replace them right now. Let's go to Minneapolis. Members of the operating engineers, this is Local 49, who work for the city of Minneapolis, have ratified a new contract. The union, which represents 110 public service workers who are equipment operators and mechanics, voted last month to authorize a strike if necessary. Local 49 said in a statement released last week, this was a challenging negotiation, but it has now come to an end, and our members look forward to continuing to do the work necessary to make the city of Minneapolis function. Budgets are a priority document, and we expect Twin Cities public sector entities to make their frontline workers more of a priority in future years. And one more here before we break. Last week, Delta Airlines issued a cease and desist letter to the Association of Flight Attendants, which is part of the CWA, AFA-CWA, nation's largest flight attendant union, after its president, Sarah Nelson, claimed that the airline had instructed its employees to come to work even if they had been exposed to COVID and were experiencing symptoms. Now, Delta's chief legal officer said this is not true. It's false and defamatory. The union responded yesterday and insisted that the statements from Sarah Nelson were truthful and accurate. Now, the news comes on the heels of the revelation. This was a couple of weeks ago that Delta had sent a letter late last year to the director of the Center for Disease Control and Prevention after staffing shortages forced it to cancel thousands of flights during the holiday season, requesting a shorter isolation period for those infected with COVID, which the agency granted a few days later. Remember, it went from 10 to 5. Well, that angered many flight attendants and also a couple of public health officials. By the way, Delta remains the largest U.S. air carrier with a non-unionized cabin crew, although the flight attendants, which does not currently represent Delta's flight crew, launched an organizing drive at the airline. That was back in 2019. All right, we have to break. You're listening to America's Workforce. Coming up next, the Parkersburg, West Virginia, Marietta, Ohio building trades.
This is America's Workforce.
It takes LIUNA to build North America's infrastructure. From roads and bridges to schools and skyscrapers, the men and women of LIUNA, the Laborers International Union of North America, build the projects we depend on. From constructing the Freedom Tower on the site of the former World Trade Center to untangling Washington, D.C.'s congested interstate, LIUNA members do the work that matters. Find out what it takes to be built by LIUNA at LIUNA.org. That's LIUNA.org.
America's Workforce Radio is sponsored in part by the International Union of Painters and Allied Trades, District Council 6, representing painters, glazers, drywall finishers, and sign and display industry workers. They remind you that belonging to a union is your right as an American.
The Heat and Frost Insulators and Allied Workers are proud to be a title sponsor for America's Workforce Radio. The Insulators Union is leading the way in the mechanical insulation industry, fire stopping, and infectious disease control. Regarded as North America's energy conservation specialists, these professionals are known for their professional work and dedication. You can learn more about the Insulators Union at insulators.org.
Union members need to be heard. Reliable and convenient union voting has never been more important than it is now. Make voting easy for your membership by working with survey and ballot systems. SBS offers encrypted and monitored solutions that ensure your elections are accurate and accessible for every member through mail-in, online, and in-person voting. Visit surveyandballotsystems.com and take the next step in getting secure and auditable elections.
Now, back to America's Workforce. Here's Ed Flash Ferens.
And don't forget, you can check us out on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. Twitter handle is at AWF Union Podcast. By the way, this next segment brought to you in part by the Ohio Federation of Teachers. You can find more at oh.aft.org. Melissa Cropper, who is president of the Ohio Federation, will be joining us next Tuesday on the show. Longtime supporter of America's workforce. Let's go to West Virginia right now and joining us, it's been a while, Buddy Malone is his name, and he heads the building trades in Parkersburg, West Virginia, and actually they cover two states, West Virginia and Ohio, and I'm reading on your website. Website, by the way, is pmbtc.org. Buddy Malone, welcome to the show, and I'm reading, let's see, 8 counties in West Virginia and 8 in Ohio. Is that right?
Correct.
Okay. Altogether, how many members would you say you represent across those two states?
So probably anywhere about 9 or 10,000.
Okay.
We've got about 50 locals, probably about close to 200 average in each of them.
Good, good, good. And how's the work going for you guys, especially now in this pandemic? I'm hearing all kind of stories as far as the vaccination goes, and then also as far as the work. A lot of construction projects going on, but what's your assessment of all that?
You know, the construction, we're kind of built for this kind of area with the pandemic. Basically, we're kind of built for it because, you know, we're used to, whether it be economic or another issue, that whether work will go up and down, just depending on the time of year or just what the economic conditions are at the time.
I understand that you've been working with a number of schools, and I'll tell you, it's so important because you're, especially in West Virginia, that state, very impoverished. I'd like to get your thoughts on Joe Manchin. I know he is the center of attention, as well as your governor. I hear your governor, Jim Justice, he got COVID real bad. Is any news on that or what?
We just heard this, like that he was going to do the state or the state address, and caught it the night before, so he had to kind of ride it in. But no really news. He caught it, but you know.
Yeah.
He's pushing the vaccine, so maybe, survive it. But
Yeah, he's fully vaccinated and boosted, I believe. Now, this is the governor, Jim Justice. He comes from the coal industry. This is the governor that made news, I want to say, maybe a year and a half ago, who talked about what they did to bring jobs to West Virginia, and they didn't materialize. Let's hear that clip real quick.
Well, the bottom line to the whole thing is just really simple. We went out and passed a right-to-work law. We got rid of prevailing wage. We built fields all over the place in thinking that they will come. They didn't come, did they?
And to date, they still haven't come, have they, buddy?
Not very much. I get to, like I said, you mentioned that we get to cover both Ohio and West Virginia, and it's night and day between the two states, and I can guarantee you that most of our work that we're getting, the projects that we're getting, are in Ohio, which is still Republican controlled, but it's still they're not right to work. They still have prevailing wage, but the jobs are coming there. They're not coming to West Virginia.
Yeah. You know, that gives me an idea. Maybe you guys should put together a report showing the fact, and this is interesting for you because you cover two states, and show the difference of what happens in a right-to-work state versus one that's not a right-to-work state. I think that would be a really good thing. That would probably get national exposure. But let's talk. I want to get into those two issues in the second segment. But let's talk about working with schools, because this is, I always say, and we've had many trades members talk about how the trades are a pathway to the middle class. So what are you doing there on behalf of the building trades to get the message across?
We got about 3 different areas that we're working on. Just recently we started working Workforce West Virginia Region 4, which covers 9 counties in West Virginia. We're working with them. We met with those superintendents of those 9 counties in December to, to discuss, what we offer as trades as an alternative to people that decide not to go to college. But it was a real good meeting. I think a lot of we were on the same page, just didn't know it. A lot of education both ways between the superintendents and us as well. And we want to follow that up in, at the end of this month in January with a meeting with the counselors to, again, just to educate them on our programs and tell them that they're in. Some people are good for college, but there's other people, even intelligent people, not just people that, you know, left over. It's intelligent people as well that have an alternative, a choice to go to the trades, and then we come out of that with without any college debt or self-funded.
Right.
And Bill Monterosa with Region 4 said it best. He said, you know, people either choose a career or settle for a career. And, you know, we're just out there putting our stuff out there, said that choice is there as well.
Are the schools still pushing them to go to college, though? Because I'm hearing that in a lot of parts of the country. I'm just wondering what it is like in West Virginia.
There has been, of course, the last decade or so, probably or more, it's been all college. But they've seen the shift. I think COVID even helped that. They've seen the shift at the lacking, where we don't have shop classes in schools anymore and things like that, that the need is out there. And it takes the education, I guess, a lot on our part to let them know that there's a viable alternative. And we're not against college. We're actually even trying to – we're working with some of the college we've had for years as trying to when people go through the apprenticeship, at the end of their apprenticeship, to have an associate's degree from a college, paid for itself. To we're working with that too, is where it's all paid for as part of their apprenticeship. To when they stop out as a journeyman for their craft, that they also have an associate's degree from a college that they can do with whatever they want to do with.
You know, a lot of people don't realize how advanced the apprenticeship programs have become over the years. I mean, the apprenticeship programs of the 70s and 80s, and maybe even the early 90s, are certainly not the ones today. And with many of them, you do get, like, college credit, like a community college. And I think that message needs to get out there. Do you think it is getting out there in some parts of the territory that you cover?
It's probably in infancy getting it back out there, but I said we're working it in several ways. We have one other area that the American Federation of Teachers, which you mentioned here at the beginning of the podcast, about Melissa Cropper, which I'm involved with as well. AFT and the National Building Trades are working together, called a Green Schools Initiative. Most of the projects are in bigger cities, but we got picked in one of our area. It's a rural area. It's Perry County, Ohio. New Lexington Schools, and they couldn't have picked a better place for a pilot project up there. The school's already involved with community, because Perry County as a whole is, like you said, it's very, there's not much there for people to work or stay in the area. So the school's got involved with a program to do whatever they can to get their, not only their students, but their community as well, to get them trained to where they can work and be able to stay in the area. So with them being picked, they've got an old elementary school they would like to, of course, remodel and make it like a workforce development center. Like I said, not only for the students, but for the community as well. And they have a great agricultural program. Of course, like I said, it's a rural area. They want to kind of add to that with the other areas of working. They started a program probably about 6 years ago for all their students from pre-K up to 12. They're taking time out of the week of their school classes to give them some kind of skills that will help them later on when they apply for a job. It could be as simple for the younger people as, you know, tell them how to shake a hand and how to look people in the eye when you're talking to them. Those soft skills, anything they can that as they go up through schools to help them be more better to apply for opportunities. So we're working with them to hopefully get the funding to remodel the school, probably have some of our apprenticeship programs in there to give them some skills to maybe give them a little heads up to where they could later become into the trades, mm-hmm. like a pre-apprenticeship program or something like that. But it's an excellent program. So they couldn't have picked a better place for a pilot project.
Whose idea was this, buddy? I mean, what a great idea, but how did it come to fruition?
I said it was a meeting between AFT and the National Building Trades. Of course, they're looking to transform the schools to, the green, cleaner air and water in the school buildings and career technical education and chances for junior apprenticeships and job training. And as I said, New Lexington was already ahead of everybody because, the community as well, there's like 40 businesses in the area that's bought into their program. They told a story of a local pizza facility there that's already taken people that's been through their school program. They were like the second worst performing facility in Ohio. They started taking the kids that come out of these programs, and now they're the second best in Ohio. So it's mm-hmm. just paying off for the local community as well. So
this is in Perry County. That's in the Ohio jurisdiction. My next question here, obviously this is successful, and I have to salute the National Building Trades, NABTU, and the American Federation of Teachers for coming together for the common good. I mean, that's awesome. When unions work together, the community benefits. We know that. Okay. Mm-hmm. Is this going to happen in West Virginia now? You got 8 counties in West Virginia to represent. Is anybody getting the message in those 8 counties?
Well, that's, it's an initiative, too. We've had, just the first steering committee on this was last, I think in November. So we're getting started there, but those guys at New Lexington are welcome. I've done talked to them. They're welcome to come down, and I told them it needs to be elsewhere, just not just there. And they're welcome to go down to come and show it to anybody that's interested. So hopefully we can expand on that in other areas. So
makes sense. It definitely makes sense. Buddy, I got to take a break. Buddy Malone joining us from the Parkersburg Marietta Building and Construction Trades Council. Website is pmbtc.org. He's the business manager as well as financial secretary and treasurer. Later in the show, Joyce Goldstein is going to run down what's been going on at the National Labor Relations Board. We're back in a few minutes.
You're listening to America's Workforce with Ed Flash Ferens.
It takes LIUNA to power North America with affordable energy. The men and women of LIUNA, the Laborers International Union of North America, have the skills needed to build and maintain oil, natural gas, nuclear, solar, and wind projects that are shaping America's energy future. From new energy tech to retrofitted facilities, LIUNA members do it all. Find out what it takes to be powered by LIUNA at LIUNA.org. That's LIUNA.org.
America's Workforce is being brought to you in part by the Communication Workers of America.
There is unity and strength for workers.
We are the USW.
We are the USW.
The United Steelworkers.
The largest industrial union in North America.
We represent 850,000 members in the U.S., Canada, and the Caribbean.
We work in metals,
rubber,
chemicals,
paper,
oil refining, atomic energy, and the service sector.
We are steelworkers, standing strong and fighting for what's right.
The AFL-CIO is a proud sponsor of America's Workforce Radio. United by efforts to raise wages, listeners to this show and workers all across America are beginning to turn a corner and drive the economic debate. The AFL-CIO is comprised of 12.5 million working people from 56 unions, but we stand with and fight for everyone who is working for a better life. For more information about our raising wages agenda, go to aflcio.org.
America's Workforce is sponsored in part by Boyd Watterson Asset Management, LLC. Find out more about our investment solutions tailored to meet the needs of Taft-Hartley funds at boydwatterson.com.
back to Ed Flash Ferens with America's Workforce.
And we are available on 6 platforms. That includes Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, iHeartRadio, Spotify, Pandora, and Stitcher. And when you get an opportunity, just sign up, receive our shows on a regular basis, and give us a rating. We always appreciate those 5-star ratings. By the way, this next segment brought to you in part by the United Labor Agency. They connect people with employment. Good employment, I might add. Good wages, great benefits. You can find more at ulagency.org. Let's go back to our live line here with Buddy Malone. Buddy's been in the building trades for 27 years, went through 2 apprenticeships, iron workers, millwrights, business agent for the millwrights for 9 years, now the business manager, financial secretary, treasurer of the Parkersburg Marietta Building and Construction Trades Council. That's an interesting background. So, iron workers and millwrights, what made you decide to go into 2 different areas, Buddy?
It started out, most of my family was iron workers. Of course, my dad, my uncles, some cousins, that's where I, of course, started into. But got the opportunity to work with the millwrights on some of the turbine projects and kind of figured out that I like that kind of work better. So they had decided they were starting to bring people in for their apprenticeships. So I started over to another apprenticeship to the millwrights. So just found out a better area to like better. So
I hear you. So we have this infrastructure bill that's signed into law, and I guess the money will start trickling in. And I know your state, like all 50 states, are going to get a nice chunk of money. So that means more work in the area. And a lot of that work is going to be prevailing wage, too. You know that. Just right. Wondering, are you ready for that? I mean, what's the projection there in the state of West Virginia, especially now taking a look at the apprenticeship programs? You said they seem to be kind of healthy. We're probably going to need more, right?
Yeah, we're always, we're always looking ahead, trying to find out. It's kind of a balancing act. We will take in as many people as we can if we know we have enough to, work out there to feed them. So the more work's available, it's more opportunities to bring people in if we know it's coming. It's like I said, it's a balancing act. You don't want to take people in and not being able to put them to work. Most places are ramping up with all this going. Actually, seen a ramp anyway. We're like everybody else in the country that the workforce participation is an issue. I think a lot of it is, the baby boomers retiring and not enough people to replace them, and COVID probably accelerated some of that retirement. So everybody's having that issue of finding enough people with more people coming. But, if we have the opportunities, we can train them. Where they're ready to vamp up if we just get them in and get the opportunities.
Is it across the board? Do we need people in all the trades? I know you represent, well over a dozen of them there, maybe 20 of them. What's the status?
Yeah, I mean, there's opportunities out there with all of this that's going to be open. Some may be more than others at times. It just depends on the construction industry itself fluctuates. But, I know the carpenters are really high. Just everybody. It's go up in the Columbus area, which is a little bit our area, with our good friend Dorsey Hager up there. But electricians are always looking for people up in that area, and Columbus is bust. So even if we don't have work in our area, we got places they can travel to, which is a good thing with the trades. But yeah, it's probably across the board. At some point, we're going to need people, and of course, if we know it's coming. Takes a little time to train the guys, so you just can't do it overnight. So
I hear you. Yeah, we just had Dorsey on the show a couple of days ago, and they're really jumping up and down over there. It looks like Intel, the chip maker, might be locating outside of Columbus, and they're talking 10,000 jobs. I mean, Columbus is on fire. They are on fire with, all kind of work, everything happening there. But you think about right. it. I mean, you got Ohio State. You got 50,000 plus students there, and then you've got a state capital. I mean, it's a hot spot. It really is.
Right.
Hopefully, we can create something in West Virginia, long overdue. I want to talk about the politics in West Virginia, first of all, is anybody trying to get rid of right to work there, or is that pretty much set in stone? What's the story on that?
We're always talking. We've got probably some headway on some of them. We just don't have enough. It's a super majority against it, getting rid of it. No good explanation why they want to keep it, but it's just a matter of fact. I mean, even prevailing wage, there's two of them that's issues that we're trying to get brought back or repealed, you know, the right to work and repeal.
Mm-hmm.
Just not getting the era that we have in Ohio. I said it's a totally different in Ohio. We have to talk with the people up there, and they understand it and the value of it, of not having right to work and the prevailing wage.
Well, they'll still keep introducing it, and it usually dies in committee in the state of Ohio. And I know Dorsey Hager has a lot to do with that, along with Tim Berga, the Ohio AFL-CIO. They see that happening. And a lot of these lawmakers that introduce right to work, they do it just for fundraising. They want to, you know, suck up to the big donors and say, hey, we tried. We didn't get anywhere, but we tried.
When I talked to the legislators, I tried to tell them, I said, we're not much different than you being a people of the legislature. If right to work was done the same way as taxes, if people decided whether they wanted to pay their taxes or not, but you as a legislature still had to build roads, provide schools for people and everything else, all the services still that you need to do, and it was up to the people whether they paid their taxes or not, how well would it happen. So we're not too different from that.
Good analogy, yeah. Yeah, you're getting the benefits of the union. You're not paying for it. Well, I'm getting my services as a citizen. Why should I pay taxes? I don't want to pay taxes.
Right.
Yeah, that'll stop everything right away. All right. We got to talk a little bit about Joe Manchin here. And I don't get it, because even the coal miners are huge in West Virginia. Not what they used to be. And nothing is in America today. And I read this comment a couple weeks ago from Cecil Roberts, and they were upset with him. And I'm talking about the Build Back Better piece of legislation, mm-hmm. which Biden is trying to get through. And the AFL-CIO did some polling on this, and they found 68% of West Virginia voters support the Build Back Better Act. Now, Joe Manchin was once your governor, and he's now your senator. And he's saying, I guess it's too expensive. Tell me, what are you hearing there, especially from the trades? And I'm sure you monitor a lot of media that's going on there. But fill me in on that one. I'm a little surprised on this one.
So we've known Joe for, of course, a long time here. And we've had a relationship with Joe. But it's Joe just being Joe. He's always believes that he can make a deal for what's best. It's not really, I think, partisan. He just has his things, and I don't think you'll be able to force Joe into something. He's going to do what he thinks is best, so our hope is that he's got the right mind and is still working towards getting something that can be passed.
Buddy, it sounds to me that the word that needs to be thrown out there is compromise, because originally I know that bill was pricier than it is now, and apparently it's still too much for him, so hopefully the two sides can come together. We still got the senator in Arizona that's got to come on board, and we got voting rights to deal with as well. You have don't you have like a voter suppression law? Did your legislature turn back the clock on voting in West Virginia as well?
They come out with us with so much, it's hard to keep track sometimes. But they're like, you know, the other, areas are not thinking right, it seems, a lot of times. It's, you know, the voting rights, I think, are probably more important than some of these others. Everybody should have an opportunity to vote. It should be easier, not harder.
I hear you. All right, buddy. I'm going to leave it on that note. Buddy Malone, who is the business manager, financial secretary, treasurer of the Parkersburg Marietta Building and Construction Trades Council. You can find more at pmbtc.org. Any parting words for our audience here as we move on to the next guest?
No, I just appreciate you coming on again. It's been a pleasure.
Well, stay safe, stay in touch, and the best of luck to the Parkersburg Marietta Building and Construction Trades Council, 10,000 strong. So we'll be talking to you down the road. All right, we're going to take a quick break. Joyce Goldstein is going to talk about the National Labor Relations Board and the changes that happened in the past year, almost a year. Back in a few minutes.
This is America's Workforce. More shows available at awfradio.com.
It takes LIUNA to keep America running. Over 70,000 public employees are part of LIUNA, the Laborers International Union of North America, delivering critical services such as healthcare and emergency response, as well as maintaining roads and sanitation systems. Even the National Postal Mail Handlers Union, representing over 47,000 U.S. postal workers, is affiliated with LIUNA. Find out what it takes for LIUNA to keep America running at LIUNA.org. That's LIUNA.org.
Chris LaGrange here, host of UCOM Live with Chris LaGrange. News, talk, sports, and workforce politics. The fastest growing podcast on, in, and around the internet. Join us live every Thursday at 4 p.m. Eastern on Facebook, Instagram, YouTube, and Twitter with archives on UCOMLive.com. Our loud and colorful panelists bring you current events like no other. So follow and subscribe today wherever great podcasts are found.
This segment of America's Workforce is brought to you by Survey and Ballot Systems. SBS has been providing unions with secure and flexible election options for over 30 years. Visit surveyandballotsystems.com to learn more.
From the Golden Gate Bridge to the St. Louis Gateway Arch, the Sears Tower, and just about every building, bridge, and structure in between, our cities and towns wouldn't be the same without ironworkers. With over 3,000 contractors employing more than 130,000 highly trained ironworkers and 20,000 apprentices, the Ironworkers Union stands ready and able to shape the future of our skylines. Learn more at ironworkers.org. Ironworkers, the sky's the limit.
Now, back to America's Workforce. Here's Ed Flash Ferens.
And don't forget, you can check us out on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. Twitter handle is at AWF Union Podcast. Well, as I indicated at the top of the show and throughout the show, there's been a lot of changes at the National Labor Relations Board, and certainly good for workers. We're seeing pockets of organizing all around the country. And joining us on line number two right now is Joyce Goldstein, Joyce Goldstein and Associates. Website is joycegoldsteinlaw.com, located in Cleveland, Ohio. And she is my expert and your expert on the National Labor Relations Board. I tell you, she gets news from them each and every day, and this is what we want to do on the show, is dissect that news. Joyce, welcome back to the show. How are we doing today?
Great. Thank you very much. It's great to be back.
Last time you and I talked, Starbucks started organizing, and that was in Buffalo, New York. Since that time, I'm reading about a dozen of them. One in downtown Cleveland is organizing. I have to ask you, what did the National Labor Relations Board do to make that happen? Because a lot of people said, no, this is not going to happen. I know it's a different day in Washington, but explain to me and our listeners what paved the way, Joyce.
Sure. I think that, you know, part of what happens is, you know, once you have a success and people are inspired by that, they continue on. So part of what I think is attributable to is legal, and part of it then becomes more political in a more general sense. But on the legal side of it, I think that, you know, from the NLRB standpoint, there are probably two different ways to think about what the NLRB did that facilitated the Starbucks organizing. On the one hand, there were procedural issues, and then on the other hand, there were substantive issues. And on the procedural side, the main thing that the NLRB has been doing is that they're speeding up election cases. And, you know, as you know, unions file election petitions with the NLRB when they're strong. They only need 30% of the workers to support an election petition, but to actually win an election, they need 50% plus one. And if a campaign, an election campaign, goes on for a long time, then the employer, that benefits employers typically. And so the longer an employer can delay, who wants to, the greater chance they have of defeating a union campaign. So when a union comes down, you know, they try to, most unions come in with a supermajority of support, not just the 30% that they need, because they know that they're going to lose support over time, typically. And so what the NLRB has been doing more recently is, under the Biden administration, is that they're not granting extensions. They're requiring parties to commit to their positions. They're holding quick hearings if necessary. They're deferring issues to the disputed issues to after an election, if they can push that down to later in the proceedings and go forward and hold the election, even if it might mean impounding ballots or holding them, but at least, you know, having the election when there's hasn't been the opportunity to destroy the majority support. You know, they're not allowing deadlines to be blown. So it's a lot of stuff that really, you know, I think contributes to getting the elections happening quicker so that the majority isn't decimated in the time. And then on the substantive side with the Starbucks case in Buffalo, as I do think we talked about before, the issue there was that the union had support in individual stores and wanted to have elections in individual stores. There were three single stores. And Starbucks, on the other hand, said that the only appropriate unit was all the Starbucks in the entire Buffalo area. And the union hadn't organized in all of the Starbucks in the whole area, so that if they had to have an election among all of the stores, then again, they probably would have lost because they wouldn't have had support. But they did have support in the individual stores. And so on the substantive side of the law, the NLRB came in and said, no, having the single store elections and separate bargaining units was appropriate. And they went forward and ordered the elections that way. So those were really, you know, both on the procedural side, on the substantive side, what paved the way for that to go forward. And then because the union won, at least in one of the stores and arguably in two of the stores, that, you know, I think that, as I said at the beginning, it inspires other workers at other Starbucks all over the country to say, well, why not us? And yeah, that, of course, is the reason why the company put so much into fighting the Buffalo situation, because mm-hmm. I think everybody understands that you know, once it starts, it starts.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, it's like dominoes, and that's what they were afraid of, and it's happening as we speak. Well, I knew I'd get a good answer from you on that one. Next on the list is ethics, and I came across a story. I talked about this the other day, that the NLRB says that they are going to vacate three Trump-era decisions. One of them was ExxonMobil Research and Engineering. The other was Marathon Petroleum. And the other was CVS Pharmacy. And the reason they want to do this is because a former board member, a Republican, William Emanuel, took part despite the fact that there were financial conflicts of interest. What's the financial conflict of interest? Well, apparently he owned stock in all three companies and did not recuse himself. Well, to me, that doesn't pass the smell test. But I want to know, what's the procedure for, like, ethics? I mean, there's got to be like a code of conduct or something with the NLRB. Talk to me about this part, because, I mean, this is something that shouldn't have happened. That's, in my opinion, what I'd like to hear from you. Go ahead.
Sure. There is a procedure. There is someone at the NLRB, they're called the Designated Agency Ethics Official, the DAEO. And the ethics official is on to William Emanuel from the get-go. I mean, as you said, there is an issue more recently that came up in connection with these three cases. And let's be clear that the conflict was that he owned stocks in excess of $50,000 in those companies. And so it wasn't just, you know, a small holding. It was a significant amount of money. But let's back up on William Emanuel, because recall he's the one who was the Trump appointee, who had been a partner at Littler Mendelsohn, which is a big management side law firm that is involved in a lot of union busting and a lot of anti-worker activity. Trump had appointed William Emanuel to the board, and initially there were issues right away about him refusing to recuse himself in cases that were Littler cases that his former law firm had been handling. And so at that time, the ethics official said, no, you, Emanuel, cannot be involved in these cases from your former law firm. And so he was forced to be recused from some of those cases earlier on. And recall, it was the McDonald's, there were a lot of cases that he was sitting on that he had a conflict with them. And so, that was back in, 2018. And then what happened after that was the NLRB, still at that time controlled by Republican board members, they then issued a report in November of 2019 that crazily said that members could insist on participating in matters where the ethics official said that they had a conflict of interest. So they do have an independent ethics official there, but the Trump board expressly put in a rule saying that they could ignore it. They could ignore what that person said. So that's what allowed Emanuel to go forward and continue, not just, in where we had the Littler conflicts, but where we have the conflicts involving this, significant financial interest. So, and how that all shook out was that in this past August 26th of 2021, the ethics opinion came out and said not only was it wrong that Emanuel had participated where he had these, financial interest in Exxon, Marathon, and CBS, but also referred these as criminal cases to the U.S. attorney in the District of Columbia, so who unfortunately declined to prosecute. It's not that there isn't a process. And yeah. Happily, at this point, the current board is saying, as you noted as in your comments, is saying, no, we're going to vacate those decisions. In fact, what they did was they issued a notice to show cause to the parties in those cases to show cause by January 28th why those cases shouldn't be vacated. So they haven't been vacated yet, but I think we see the handwriting on the wall.
Okay,
on that,
yeah.
Thankfully.
They're moving in that direction. That's amazing. So the bottom line, there is a code. There is a rule. And during the Trump administration, they said, well, even though there is a rule, you don't have to follow the rule. Is that what I'm hearing, Joyce?
Correct. That's exactly what happened. Really, okay. They issued a report that said exactly that. November 19th, 2019 said that they don't have to pay attention to what the ethics official says.
That's amazing. Well, it should come as no surprise from the previous administration. Oh, my gosh. There is so much more. And you know what? We're running out of time. I wanted to get into the fact that I guess the NLRB wants to take another look at the independent contractor status in America, which is so huge. And we're going to have to save that for another show. Many complain about being misclassified on their job. And I think, too, during the Trump administration, they kind of tweaked that a little bit, benefiting the independent contractor status and keeping that in place. But let's leave that for another discussion. OK, how does that sound?
Sounds fine with me.
Love talking to her. Joyce Goldstein, been practicing law for over 4 decades. Joyce Goldstein and Associates, you can find more at joycegoldsteinlaw.com. That's it for another edition of America's Workforce. Coming up on Monday, Jeff Bryant from the Independent Media Institute. We're going to talk about schools and school funding. And Robert Chap Thortman on behalf of the United Association. Until then, all of you have a safe and wonderful weekend.
That concludes another episode of the America's Workforce Radio Podcast. Thanks for listening, and be sure to subscribe so you never miss a show. America's Workforce is a production of Labor Tools and BMA Media Group. Find out more information online at labortools.com.